Hey everyone, welcome in to the Woj Pod. My guest today, former Los Angeles Lakers general manager, Mitch Kupchak. He won three NBA titles as a player with the Washington Bullets and the Lakers, and won two more as the architect of NBA champions with the Lakers. In his first extended interview since his dismissal from the Lakers in February, Mitch talks about his end in LA, the championships, the bus family dynamic, Kobe Bryant, and the aftermath of the failed Chris Paul trade. We talk a little bit about his Long Island roots, Dean Smith, and the North Carolina Tar Heels, and a whole lot more on the modern NBA. Here's my conversation with Mitch Kupchak. Welcome into our New York studio with Mitch Kupchak. Mitch, how are you?
Adrian, thank you. Doing great.
You grew up on the island, on Long Island, and almost any player, great player from the island, sort of the rite of passage, right, was to migrate into Manhattan, into the city, and get to the playground and play. Was that part of it for you as a kid?
Well, when I began playing basketball, which was really late in life, I was an eighth grader. It was an informal process, and I was just learning the game. When I got into high school, you know, you became of age to drive, or the friends that I played with became of age to drive. The answer is yes. You know, we didn't have access to gyms that were open, you know, like they have access today. And in order to, you know, get better at the game, you had to pile in a car, you know, and drive someplace and go where the games were. Of course, you know, if you live in the city, you could walk a couple of blocks or take a subway. We had to pile into a car. Frankie Alasia, who played at St. John's, Bieber Smith, who played at St. John's, those were guys my age, a couple of guys from my high school team. We'd find out where the games are, you know, whether it was the community college or the record tournament, and we'd hop in a car and we'd go play. And all the games were outdoors.
Your son's a scholarship player at UCSB now, and you and I were talking about this off-air about pick up basketball at all levels. It is how kids play now, much more structured, organized, travel team. We're going to go in the gym and shoot on the gun. It's so different from the experiences of your generation.
Well, everything's changed. I mean, the game, the way it's played today versus 30 to 40 to 50 years ago is a completely different game. And I think it's a good game today. And if you watch the pace of the game, the three-point shot, the rules that the NBA has enacted where there's less contact and it lets players show off their athletic ability, I think it's all really good. You know, back, you know, 20 to 30 years ago, there wasn't as much structure. The AAU, you know, was becoming a part of high school kids, but not what it is today. And, you know, my high school coach, Stan Kellner, had complete control, you know, over the program and over me. Today, it's really the AAU coaches that have complete control, and the high school coach finds himself with very little control over the player. And I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. The shoe companies certainly are a big part of it. You know, they subsidize the AAU programs. And there's a whole big picture here where, you know, you get to know the kids when they're young, and hopefully there's a loyalty to the shoe program. And then they go to colleges, and the colleges are identified with certain shoes. Some colleges are Under Armour, some are Adidas, some are Nike. And, you know, you don't really know if the players are being filtered, you know, from the AAU level into similar colleges. You know, you don't really know.
Well,
but certainly what goes on today is different than it was 30 years ago.
You mentioned Stan Kellman, your high school coach. You were a baseball pitcher as a young teen. Do you ever wonder if you don't show up at Brentwood High School, do you become a basketball player? Do you stay on the baseball track? Did he intercede in your life, your career?
Well, I grew up in the 60s on Long Island. And if you were on Long Island in the 60s, you know, especially the very beginning, 60, 61, 62, you were a Yankee fan. The Dodgers and the Giants had left town already. And the Mets, I'm not sure exactly sure when the Mets came in, 62, 63. But at that point, I was already a Yankee fan. And I was already a baseball fan, and I was a Mickey Mantle fan. I think all kids that grew up in the late 50s and the early 60s, you know, in New York were Mickey Mantle fans, especially since the Dodgers and the Giants were gone. And baseball was my first love. So that's what I did. You know, I played baseball during the winter. I'd pound my glove, you know, in the house when it's snowing outside. You get the oil, you get the baseball, and you throw the baseball in the glove, and you mess around with the fingers, and you pull the strings a little bit tight, and you try to get that perfect pocket.
Did you put the elastic band over the glove
yes.
and then put the ball in
yes.
it when you'd oil it?
Of course.
Yep.
Of course I did. I grew up in an area where there's a lot of track housing, which is in Brentwood, Long Island. A lot of kids on my block, and we would just play sports seasonally. You know, if it was football, you'd play football, touch football on the street. If it was the baseball season, which was my love, I played baseball. We had a basketball hoop on the block, but I played very little basketball, to be honest with you. In eighth grade is when I first played organized basketball. I'm not sure how old you are in eighth grade, 12 or 13 years old. I was about 6'5", about 175 pounds. Did not look good in a uniform at all. Very self-conscious of my size. I was at least a foot bigger than everybody else in my junior high. You know, so you kind of walked around, couldn't get pants to fit, couldn't get shoes to fit. I really felt, you know, kind of awkward. So in a basketball uniform, you know, it was the same feeling. And quite frankly, we were putting away a trampoline at the end of the school, getting ready for basketball practice, and the trampoline folded onto my wrist, and I broke my wrist, which ended my eighth grade season. And you know something? I wasn't upset that my basketball season ended. I was kind of happy to be in a cast at that point. But in ninth grade, yes, a coach by the name of Stan Kellner, who was the high school coach, you know, cornered me in the hallway. Must have been for 45 minutes. I know I missed a class. You know, the kids are walking back and forth twice, you know, the beginning of the class. Right. And then the bell rings and the same kids are walking by at the end of the class. And I'm still talking to this guy in the hallway. He's about 6'1", I'm about 6'7", 6'8", and he's just looking up at me, and I didn't say a word for 45 minutes. And it was all about, you know, what you can become. You're looking at a scholarship for college. You can help your parents. This is something that's going to be good for you. You're going to have to work hard. What are you going to do this summer? He went on and on and on and on. It was kind of like negotiating by beating somebody to death. And after 45 minutes to an hour, I said, okay, I'll do it. I said, what does that entail? He says, well, you can have to give up most of your summer. So I said, let me think about it. And I went home and I talked to my mom and dad about it. Neither of who were sports fans, you know, growing up in Manhattan, you know, in the 20s and the 30s, it was a different lifestyle here. And then there was a war that broke out. So sports wasn't a really big part of their lives. You know, it was about raising four kids. My dad had a good construction job. But he got up very early, went to bed very early, and sports wasn't really a part of their lives. So I think the thing that resonated with them was that maybe this can translate into a college, you know, scholarship. And anyway, to make a long story short, I did commit that summer to going to the camps. Smithtown, Gus Alfieri, Brentwood had a summer league. There was a couple of camps in New Hampshire, in Vermont, sleepaway camps. I remember one of the camps, the pros were Jerry Lucas, Lenny Wilkins, Larry Costello, and Cliff Hagan. I remember I played against Jerry Lucas in the counselor pro game, and I thought he was the strongest man I had ever met in my life trying to guard him. But that's how I got involved in basketball, and my Brentwood High School, we had really good teams. And in 10th grade, we had some veterans, and we ended up having great success, and I got better. And when I got better, I enjoyed the game more, and I had more confidence in myself, and I worked harder. And that's kind of how it worked out. I mean, obviously, the harder you work, the better you get at something.
And I love this part of people's lives, that those formative years, and especially the way recruiting was then and how different everything was around the basketball world. And we'll get to the Lakers career and managerial career there. But when you're getting recruited at that age, like, I think people now, kids, you see coaches on television so much more. The games are on. Maybe the coaches don't seem as bigger than life because you just see them. The access to them is different now. When you were growing up, when Dean Smith came in, or, and I know Notre Dame, you know, Digger Phelps had been at Fordham, goes to Notre Dame. What was it like to be a top player in high school at that time and then have those kinds of figures from those kinds of institutions coming to Brentwood High School on the island?
Well, I do remember going to St. John's Notre Dame at Alumni Hall, and Lou Carnesecca was not the coach then. He had left to coach the Nets. So Frank Molzoff was the head coach at that point, and he was recruiting me. Digger, you mentioned, was at Fordham until 1971, I think. I graduated 72 from high school, and he went on to Notre Dame and ended up recruiting me for Notre Dame. That game at Alumni Hall when Austin Carr was playing, yes. You know, you walk into that building, it was packed, and I felt, I said, wow, this is something that you really don't, this feeling you don't get, you know, watching games on TV. And at North Carolina, you know, John Lotz, who was the assistant coach, you know, would recruit me for North Carolina. Eddie Fogler, who was one of the assistants. And when John Lotz walked into my high school, I'll never forget it. He was like 6'5", 6'6". He wore a black leather jacket, the black boots, you know, with the big heel, and he had a black pair of pants on and then some kind of a shirt. And, you know, walking through my high school halls and coming to see me and somebody would say, hey, there's this guy here who's just the coolest guy in the world, John Lotz, to recruit you for North Carolina. Very, very, I was impressed. And the first time I ever got on an airplane was the fall of my senior year in high school, was to go on a recruiting trip to Texas Christian. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it was a long time ago, but the whole process was different then.
Dean Smith, to play for Coach Smith, a elite coach at the top of the profession, but it was the 70s. It wasn't quite a legend mm-hmm. yet. The coach you found as an 18-year-old and then the coach who goes on to coach into the, you know, well into the 70s, the 80s at Carolina, as consistent of a person as you've ever known?
It came down to Notre Dame and North Carolina. And I would go back and forth. Man, I love North Carolina uniforms. They had the V-necks. I love the socks that went up to the knees with the numbers on them. They had a couple of New York kids on the team when I visited. I felt really, really at home when I went to the school for my weekend visit. But really, the most impressive, you know, and John Lotz recruited me. When Dean Smith came into my high school to watch me practice one day, you know, practice stopped. You know, he wasn't Coach Smith from the 80s and the 90s, but he was on his way to being, you know, one of the very, very top, you know, top college coaches in the country. Best decision I ever made. I know my high school coach, Stan Kellner, was a big Dean Smith fan, and maybe he was a little bit biased. You know, he was a basketball person. He loved the game himself, so he had a unique take on the recruitment process. You know, I know there were a lot of promises being made, you know, not so much to me, maybe some to my high school coach, some to my mom and dad, to this date that my mom and dad won't share with me from other college coaches. But the North Carolina people, Dean Smith didn't promise me anything. And that was the first year of the freshman eligibility rule. So it was very easy to get a college coach to say, Mitch, you're going to start for us as a freshman. Okay, the only thing Dean Smith would say, you know, if you work hard and you do good in studies, you know, you'll have a chance to play. That's the only thing I can promise you.
He wasn't promising spots on the 76 Olympic team.
No, I'm not even sure he knew he was the coach. He was going to be the coach, but no, he didn't.
The fraternity that exists, and I've seen this with you in public places where I love it, because if any ex-player sees Maktar Injai, who played at Carolina, who now works for the Knicks, had been an agent, I think he saw you in a restaurant we were both in, and he jumped to his feet immediately to shake your hand. And after said that was one of the lessons Dean Smith taught, was if you see an ex-Carolina player, an alumni, you get on your feet to shake their hand. And Maktar said, I'll do it till the day I die. Like, it's just in you. And it's one thing to do that when you're on campus as a kid, but to see guys who are 20, 25 years removed, it seems like the Carolina, the Coach Smith, it's with you in ways you probably maybe don't even think about every day.
Yeah, he really promoted, you know, a program based on inclusion and family. The story you're telling me about Maktar is 100% true. You know, the players, when I got there, you know, they were players from the early and mid-60s. You know, those are the people, the Larry Browns and the Doug Moes. You know, I think Doug played for Coach McGuire. And then Billy Cunningham and Larry Miller and, you know, a bunch of Dennis Wysicks. You know, they were the guys that included me, you know, as a part of their family. And I graduated in 76. The guys I played with that people might know a little bit about, George Carl, Bobby Jones, Walter Davis, Lagarde, Kuster. I know I'm missing a couple of names, which I hate to name names because you're always going to miss somebody. But that was the guys I played with. And then the guys after me in 76, we always felt as if there was a common connection between all of us. Cause I felt that way with the guys that were at Carolina before me. And, yeah, we'd always get out of our way. Who's that over there? Even if you never met the player, you know, you'd walk over and say, "Hey, I'm so-and-so. I went to North Carolina. I know you graduated 30 years mm-hmm. later." And they would say, "Yeah, I know who you are." And you'd have a common, you know, today we talk about Roy Williams. Okay, but for 30 years, we talked about Dean Smith and Coach Guthridge. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I mentioned Coach Lotz and Roy Williams. Mm-hmm. And then Roy went to Kansas. Mm-hmm. And Roy, to this day, has tried to promote the same exact atmosphere. In fact, every year for 30 years, Dean Smith had a golf outing in Pinehurst, North Carolina. And it started out, he'd invite the North Carolina guys to go back, and there'd be six or seven of them, you know, Cunningham, Mo, Larry Brown, and then, of course, Roy was included, and then, you know, George Carl, and, you know, guys that would play golf. And Coach would invite other basketball people also. Bill Raftery, one of my favorite people of all time, and a lot of other coaches, you know, would come. And then, of course, you know, 10 years, whatever it was, 98, 90, well, 3 years ago, Coach, you know, passed away, and he really couldn't play golf for the 2 or 3 years before that. And Roy was the coach in North Carolina. Okay, but Roy kept that same tradition going forward, you know, at Pinehurst. And 3 weeks ago, we just got back, and there was about 16 basketball people there. And, yeah, Larry Brown was there. Doug Moe was there. Roy was there. George Carl was there. I was there. Buzz Peterson were there. So it kind of covered, you know, players from the early 60s, you know, through the 80s and 90s. And that's the kind of atmosphere that's been in North Carolina, you know, as far back as I can remember. And hopefully Roy can keep it going and continue to win at the same rate he's winning at. You know, 3 championships in 14 years is just off the charts. You know, and Roy is, I'm hoping coaches 10 more years, but I don't know if he can do it.
7 months ago, almost to the day, I think, you were let go with the Lakers. Magic Johnson came in at first as a kind of a senior advisor consultant, then was named the president. Training camps are starting in a couple of days. I'm guessing that you've had a team this time of year. You've had a team every year since, you mentioned, eighth grade. You wake mm-hmm. up in the morning and there's a routine to your life, to the season, to the calendar. How different is it all now to not have sort of that structure and, you know, sort of that purpose that you had with a team, with an organization for, you know, for a very long time?
Well, the good part about it is that time has really gone slowly. You know, since that date you talked about, I haven't looked at my watch to see if it's correct, if it's to the date or not, but I know it was in February. Time has gone slowly, and I don't know if it's been 6 or 7 months, but it seems like I've been able to do so much more, you know, than I've ever done before in my life in terms of getting things accomplished, spending time with my family. My mom is, you know, knock on wood, 92 years old, still doing great on Long Island. I spent time with my sister, my brother, a lot of friends and connections that, you know, because of the time needed to do the job correctly, you don't spend as much time with them as you should. When you're involved in basketball with a program, whether it's college or the NBA as a player or as a manager, you know, the seasons go so quickly. I mean, it seems like one thing goes into another, into another, into another. You're always trying to think ahead, and not just a month or two ahead. You're trying to think a year or two or three ahead. And time just flies by. And you look back on it and you almost say, well, where did the 20 years go? But I am in a period now where you do have to create your own structure, your own schedule. It's not created for you. Training camps do start next week, and I'm not affiliated with the team right now. Don't think I will be by the time training camp starts next week anyway. So it'll be an awkward moment. I do intend on, you know, spending some time with some NBA teams, making sure I'm relevant in terms of the players and coaching style, spending time with GMs to see how they do their job and in the office. So it's different. It's going to be unique, you know, for a year. You know, what the future holds for me, I'm not quite sure right now.
Why do you think the Lakers Magic Genie at the time made the decision to let you go? Your thought about it then, and then as time has passed here, it felt like you were going to, there was going to be a window of having maybe more time with Magic in that role. And then suddenly there was a more abrupt end than I think most imagined.
I think that's accurate. I've been with the organization for 36 years. I'm not sure it's realistic to think that I was going to be with them for another 10, 15, or 20 years. I think 36 years is a heck of a run, and that's how I prefer to look at it. I came as a player in 81, and then I retired as a player in 86 and went into the front office to work with Jerry West, which was the best thing ever to happen to me, those 14 years with him. He retired in 2000, and I took over as a general manager in 2000. So there was a great run, and I'm thankful to have such a run like that. Magic has always been a big supporter of mine and a friend. We would talk all the time, especially when he was an owner, had an ownership interest. You know, he would always be supportive, help recruit, and talk through player possibilities with me throughout the years. You know, when he sold his interest and went to the Dodgers, things changed a little bit, but not a whole lot. When he came into the office as an advisor to work with Genie, yeah, of course, everybody kind of like, you know, they nod their head to the side and they start to think, well, what's going on here? You know, for a second, I was one of them, but I always felt my relationship with him would withstand anything that might happen. I think as a group, the two of us, Jimmy and myself, we imposed maybe some unrealistic guidelines as to when the team can be competitive and how quickly we can do it. I think in today's world, it takes more time under the existing collective bargaining agreement with 30 very, very competitive teams and 30 very competitive owners. And I felt we were on our way with young, talented players. We signed a couple of veterans this past summer, and we preserved cap room going forward. But I felt the urgency to do it quicker was there. And, of course, you know, Jim made some comments a couple of years ago about getting into the playoffs maybe this year. You know, maybe that added on to the urgency, you know, with us. Maybe it gave some people the ability to say, well, you know, they said they were going to do this and they're not doing it as quickly as we thought. So I think that may have been a factor. You know, we didn't get it back to where we said we would as quickly as we said it would. We would. Why did it happen? You know, when it did, I'm not exactly sure. It was a week before the trade deadline. Maybe they just felt, and I haven't spoken to anybody since, you know, there. So I don't know what their thought process was. So I'm really clearly just speculating. Maybe they just thought, maybe they just said, well, if you're going to make a change at the end of the year, then why don't we do it now so we can control how the trade deadline goes? I mean, that's the only thing I could think of. Having said all that, you know, I've made business decisions for the Lakers that I know were not always popular. When Dr. Buss was alive, he was always on board. And when Jimmy and I worked together, he was always on board. But I've made business decisions that weren't always popular, you know, in the building. So I understand that people have to make those kinds of decisions. And I did it. I don't hold a grudge against anybody. Clearly, Jeannie made this decision. She has complete authority, you know, to run that organization the way she wants to run it. Once again, how really, you know, upset can I be after 36 years, you know, with an organization like that? And they've treated me very well.
You mentioned right around that trade deadline time, there was a deal you had talked with, I think, Sacramento about. DeMarcus Cousins, Sacramento ended up doing a deal with New Orleans for him. Was there anything around those trade talks, the decisions you made about what you offered, that you think became a part of the timing of the decision, that became a jumping off point based on your memories of, you know, your conversations with Magic, Genie at that time? Was that a factor, do you think?
Well, I'm not going to speculate and, you know, try to figure out, you know, what other teams, the players they had were, they were looking at as opportunities. I do know that, yes, you know, at that time of year, we're busy. We're talking to teams. And I know what we would do or what I would advocate for. So perhaps, you know, that might have been part of the reason. I don't know.
Time now for a quick message from Spotify. Every episode of the Woj Pod is now available on Spotify, and I know what you're thinking. Wait a minute. Spotify has podcasts? Yes, your place for all things music now has the world's most popular podcasts. To stream the Woj Pod on Spotify, open the app, tap Browse, and look for us in the podcast section. Follow us and all your favorites to get new episodes dropped into your library as soon as they drop. For more, head to Spotify.com/podcasts. And now back to my guest, Mitch Kupchak. As you were involved, Mitch, with free agency and those final few years on the job, you know, listen, there's more scrutiny on free agency. It's covered in a way, the details of all of it is covered in a way that it hadn't always been covered. I don't know how much it all changed, except there's more attention on it. A criticism people will, some might see it as a criticism, others see it as an example of ethics, of good ethics, that there's this perception that business was done in a way in the league of lots of essentially tampering before free agency, July 1 start. And that, listen, any agent you talked with, any other team, people, there were rules, you followed them. And if somebody wanted to try to have a prearranged deal in April, May, it was against league rules that you were not going to engage in that. And then all of a sudden it's been, you know, it gets spun into, hey, that's a competitive disadvantage. Were you hearing it at the time? Did you have to measure yourself? Is this league changing in a way that I've got to change with it? How did you factor all of that into the way you did your job?
Well, Adrian, I hope the league is not changing. I mean, there are rules. There has to be rules and structure in any sport, any society, and the people have to buy in. Clearly, there may be, you know, some people in this league that don't follow the rules. I think there aren't many. I think by and large, the general managers in this league, they all adhere to the rules and they follow the rules and they have great faith in this league and they have great faith that everybody else is following the rules. You know, on the other side of the table, you know, you have the representatives. There are 30 general managers in the NBA, and there must be close to 1,000 representatives that represent players. So you're talking about 30 guys that have to adhere to the rules, and you're talking about 1,000 representatives that have rules, but they really don't have the same enforcement that the NBA does. And they're out there doing what they feel they need to do to get their players the edge in the negotiation and in free agency. And you know something? If I were an agent or a representative, I might do the same thing. You know, the ramifications for being a representative and maybe calling a GM too early are not nearly the same as it is for a general manager to take a phone call from an agent prior to July 1st. So you have this whole underbelly of representatives that create a frenzy about contacting general managers, and they're hoping that they can get somebody that would break the rule. And they try to perpetuate this atmosphere that everybody's doing it. And I don't believe that's the case. I don't believe that's the case at all. There is a gray area, you know, where maybe you get a phone call from an agent in mid-June and you say, listen, I hear you. Let's talk July 1st as soon as we can. Mm-hmm. And maybe the agent hears that and says, well, he hears me. I was talking about my client July 1st. He wants me to call him on July 1st. They have interest. So maybe that's a gray area you could go into. Mm-hmm. But are there general managers cutting deals, you know, for players prior to July 1st? I would be surprised. I would be very surprised.
How about a situation like with a Kevin Durant free agency where teams are trying to get into meetings and meetings are set up? I think the rule is you can't set it up till July 1. Well, when there's – that's a tough one. We know the meetings are set up. Sometimes they'll get reported. Right. Even the Durants, the Lakers didn't get a meeting. The Knicks didn't get a meeting at that time. How did you handle it?
Well, certain players are only going to – I mean, today's player, to their credit, a lot of today's players – of course, certain guys, if you're a maximum player, you're going to get paid. Okay? Beyond that, it's okay. I'm getting my money. Now do I want to win? So certain players today, they're only – providing they've been financially taken care of, their next piece of information that they need and they want is, I want to win. So certain players, no matter what, you know, you can offer. It's the max for everybody. Right. It's the same amount of money. They're going to say, well, I can get that from everybody. I want to go where I can win. And that's going to dictate whether or not certain teams get that player to visit them. Now, our team 2 years ago wasn't set up to win. We're in a rebuilding stage where it's going to take 3 or 4 years. And having said that, I do like the young players on the Laker team. I think they are, you know, right where they need to be. They're getting better and better and better. But those players, their most important thing is to dictate where they're going to play so they can win.
You mentioned, too, the advantage when you recruited – when you and Jerry West went after Shaq in free agency, it was at a time when you could outbid everybody. It was a different climate in free agency with Shaq than modern free agency, right? It was dramatically different about how you'd go about your business and going after a guy.
Well, I'm not exactly sure when the salary cap was introduced. I think it was introduced – you know, my first or second year in Los Angeles would have been like 1982 or 1983. I remember it being like a $5 or $6 million salary cap. That was the beginning of a series of collective bargaining agreements where each one changed and became more and more sophisticated, more and more structure. And as the league grew and as the ownership changed over the years, there's a big time push to create as level a playing field as possible. And this is something that's been in the works for over 30 years. So what happened, you know, 20 years ago with Shaquille, we were into the salary cap era, but there wasn't max limits on players. There wasn't, I think there was a maximum number of years, but it could have been 7. You know, today it's 4 or 5. There were totally different constraints on free agency than there are today. Today, the draft pick is so much more valuable than it once was. Just having cap room alone doesn't allow you to rebuild your team. As I mentioned earlier, once the player, the great players, get the money, they want to go to a place where they're going to win. And why not? And I think that's something that's a good thing. So if you have a team that's in a rebuilding stage, and even though you have money, it's going to be difficult to get that player that can get that same money anywhere, including his home team, yet have a much better chance to win a championship and to create a legacy that he wants to have. So today we have an environment where there's 30 teams. The league, and understandably so, is trying to create as competitive, a balanced league as possible. And the rules are completely different than they were 30 years ago and completely different than they were 15 years ago. So today, your draft picks, your cap room, the way you spend your money, the way you plan for the future, it's clearly different than it once was. Even making a trade today is so much harder than it was what once was. I mean, we used to joke 15 years ago how hard it was to make salaries equal. When making a trade, it didn't seem to make much sense. If two GMs wanted to make a deal, why do the salaries have to be equal? Okay, well, to some degree, that's still the extent of the understanding and the agreement. But there are so many more rules that go into making a trade that weren't here 15 years ago. So it's an evolving environment. Overall, you can't argue that it's been bad for the NBA. Ratings are as high as they've ever been. Personally, the game is, for me, so much fun to watch. I love watching the way the game is played today. And I think of all the major sports out there, and I really don't have a lot to go on, but I think basketball has got as much upside as any sport that's out there today.
Mitch, if you were given the opportunity to make decisions in a vacuum, to not have Jim Buss having publicly and privately, you know, there was this, we've got to get into the playoffs and get to a conference final within the window, which is really impossible to, that's tough to do in this league. That's a hard place to get very quickly. With full autonomy in a vacuum, would you have gone into a complete rebuild in L.A.? Would you have gone Mozgov deal, Luol Deng? Could you have done what Philadelphia did? Could you ever do that with the Lakers?
Well, we were in a rebuild year, the year we signed Kobe to that two-year deal. At that point, in our minds, we were into a rebuild. And having Kobe for those 2 years, although that wasn't a big part of the plan, it ended up being a major cushion or buffer for us because our fans, our partners, fans around the world were happy to have Kobe on the court for two more years. But our team was in a rebuild. And we got good picks. And we were able to get good young players. We were able to create cap room. And at some point, to answer your question, there was a feeling of urgency that, okay, it's been 2 or 3 years. You know, can we hurry this process along? Because you know you can't win with only young players. And we heard all the talk. You know, L.A. hasn't been in the playoffs for the last 3 years or the last 4 years. You know, so was there a little bit of an urgency or a push to try to move it along? Absolutely. And the only way to move it along is to get young players, let them mature. Hopefully you've drafted some players that are going to be good players, and then add, you know, the right veterans to that group. So with Mozgov and Deng, that's what we did, and we felt that we'd also preserve cap room for the next year, which we did. There was cap room for yet a max player, which would have been this past summer, the summer that just ended. So that was our feeling, to move the because you just can't continue to kick the can down the road forever. You know, at some point you do have to give your fans, you know, something that's not just young and has a little bit of hope there, but you have to start winning some games too. And our hope was is that we could, you know, continue to win some, you know, build to win some games now, and at the same time preserve some flexibility and give our young players a chance to grow.
Mitch, how did you learn over time to navigate the family dynamic of the Buss family in the job? When Jerry Buss owned the team and ran it, it was one dynamic. And then when Jerry started to hand off control to Jim, and then when Jerry passed, it became a completely different dynamic. What was that process like for you in doing your job?
Well, when I came to the Lakers in 81, you know, Dr. Buss's four children, we're all the same age. You know, they're all in their late 50s, early 60s. And I got to know each of them very well. You know, as, you know, young, you know, all hanging out at the forum, you know, 25 to 26, 27, you know, 22, 24 years old. I was 27 years old. And I developed a relationship with all of them. Okay. But now when you're someplace, you know, for 36 years and everybody's, you know, getting older and having families and getting married and, you know, everything is, you know, your relationships do change. I think that's natural. And as time went on, it was clear that Dr. Buss wanted to keep this franchise in the family, and he wanted his family members to run the franchise. Okay, that was clear. And he made, you know, a conscious effort to put the people that he felt or that wanted to work most. Some of them didn't want to spend, some of them had families and didn't want to spend full time there. So he put, you know, Jeannie in charge of business and Jimmy slowly in charge of basketball. And it was clear to me that Dr. Buss, my relationship with him in 2000, he and I did the basketball. And then 5 or 6 years later, you know, Jimmy was introduced, you know, more and more and more. And then eventually he said to me, Mitch, I want you to work with Jimmy. I don't want to work as much day to day as I once did. So it was his wish that I work directly with Jimmy. And of course, Dr. Buss was involved in all the major decisions. Okay, but my day-to-day contact became Jimmy. So when Dr. Buss passed away, major loss. you know, for sports, for the Lakers, for our fan, for me. And it was simple. You know, when he was there, he kept everything under control. And not that it wasn't under control, you know, once he passed away. But as we talked about, Jeannie was put in charge. She felt a big-time responsibility to oversee the franchise. And for various reasons, you know, some I would only speculate on, which I really can't do. The bottom line to me was that we indicated that we would be a playoff team in four or five years, and we didn't follow through on it. And when you kind of indicate that and you don't follow through on it, then all chips are off the table, and the decision was made. Now, I think it's easy for me because I'm just an employee. I can't imagine how hard it was for her and the family because you're talking about brothers and sisters.
Hey, Mitch, sit tight for a minute so I can tell my listeners about SeatGeek. They've come along and created an amazing app and website that makes it easier than ever for fans to buy and sell tickets. They pull all the tickets available on other sites into one place, so you save time and you never miss a deal. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and they'll let you know if the ticket prices fall. And even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat. And best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. They show you the full ticket price from start to finish and never try to bamboozle you with big fees on the checkout page. My listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. That's $20 right into your pocket. To get it, all you've got to do is this. Download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab and click add a promo code, then enter promo code WOJ. SeatGeek will then send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. It does not get any easier than that. So please support SeatGeek like they support us here at the Woj Pod. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code WOJ today. And now back to my guest, Mitch Kupchak. How much autonomy did you feel you had in the job? Did autonomy come and go as relationships changed, evolved in that family? Did you always feel, as GM of the Lakers, you could make the deal you wanted to make?
Everything always had to be run through Dr. Buss when he was alive. You know, I never made a deal and then told him about it later on. You know, that just didn't happen. When he wasn't around, when he passed away, it was Jimmy and I, and anything that I was going to do, you know, I would have to run through Jimmy, and Jimmy would have to give his approval. Sometimes he would be, you know, completely on board. Sometimes he wouldn't be as much on board, and he'd say, Mitch, well, I trust your judgment. Okay, but that's kind of how it was, you know, after Dr. Buss passed away. Jeannie, to her credit, understood what Dr. Buss wanted, that Jimmy was in charge of basketball, and she did not mingle or interfere with any basketball decisions. You know, she gave us the independence we needed.
The decision you made to hire Mike D'Antoni over Phil Jackson to bring Phil back as coach, did that have an impact within the walls of the building for you, do you think?
I think you know the answer to that question. I like to answer a lot of questions sometimes with the word maybe. but I hope we're not talking about Mike D'Antoni, if he's a good coach or not.
Right.
I mean, Mike D'Antoni, I think he just won Coach of the Year in the NBA, and it's not the first time he's won it. He might not have been the perfect coach for that team at that time, but Mike D'Antoni is an excellent, excellent coach. In fact, he's changed the game, should get credit for changing the game. And if you enjoy watching the game the way the game is played today, you should credit Mike D'Antoni for that. But yes, Phil did not want to coach. Jim and I met with him at his home, and it was a struggle to get him to be enthusiastic about coaching. He knew that our team had a chance to be good that year, and he knew that we were struggling as an organization. We had just let Mike Brown go. We had this team that had a chance to be really, really good. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of public pressure. In fact, he mentioned it on the organization to hire a coach and to produce a team as good as the team talent we had. I felt that if he coached, it's only because he felt the pressure to do it. Now, whether that was coming from the people that he came up to him when he was at a restaurant, I'm sure he and Jeannie were talking about it. Maybe Jeannie said, this is something that, you know, you should consider. I don't know. But Phil, in my mind, the coaching part was behind him already. And he indicated that if he did come back and coach, it would probably only be for 1 year. So Jim and I talked about it. And rather than, you know, hire a coach for just 1 year and be in the same spot like 6 months from now, you know, we decided to move on to Mike D'Antoni. Of course, you can look back on it now and say, hey, maybe that wasn't the best decision. But at the time, that's the information that we had. And like I said, you can't criticize Mike D'Antoni. He's a great, great coach in this league.
And even at the time, you had brought Steve Nash in, and there was obviously that familiarity. And I remember pretty clearly you obviously talked to him at different points about it. Kobe was really enthusiastic about Mike D'Antoni. He knew him from USA Basketball. He liked the idea, I think, of having a system in place as he got older to maybe facilitate offense for him. It was not an unpopular decision within that locker room at the time. Was that your sense?
That's correct. We did have a lot of talent of varying styles of play. You know, just going by memory, I mean, we had Kobe. I think we had Powell. I think we had Steve Nash. We had Dwight Howard. So each of those players, you know, plays the game, you know, differently. And maybe collectively, it would have been tough to find a style of play that they could all fit into. And, you know, Kobe was closer to the end of his career than he was the beginning of his career. Dwight was right in the middle. So you're not as open to play a game a certain way as you might be if you were much younger. And I'm not saying, you know, I'm not just saying that about Kobe, but, you know, Pau Gasol, I remember Pau Gasol, you know, Mike D'Antoni put Pau in the corners to take 3-point shots. Now, he didn't start him a couple of games, and I think that upset Pau, understandably so. But he encouraged Pau to take 3-point shots. And I think at the time, Pau was thinking, well, I don't take 3-point shots. I'm a mid-range shooter and a post player. Okay, but look at the NBA today. How many 3-point shots did Powell take last year? How many did Marc Gasol take last year? Okay, how about Horford or how about Brook Lopez? Okay, guys that never took a three and were strictly mid-range or post-up players 5 years ago, all of a sudden they're now taking hundreds of 3-point shots a game and they're loving it. So a lot of it's like working through the mindset and saying, listen, this is the direction the game's going. Let's do this and play this way. Well, sometimes it takes a while for the player to work their way through that. And I think that was part of the problem.
You mentioned Pau Gasol, and that was a point where you had been out of the playoffs a year. You'd had a first-round defeat. You were trying to find that co-star for Kobe, or certainly a second impactful player to pair with him. Putting that deal together for Pau gave a second wind to your run there. You go on to win titles. And how long did those talks go on for Pau? Had he been a guy you had identified, or had he been a guy who became available and you jumped it, finding a way to make a deal?
I'm not exactly sure how, you know, we learned he was available. I think a lot of times during the course of a season, you know, you talk to your counterparts at other teams, whether they call you or you call them, and they say something or you say something, and that leads to another question. And sometimes it's planned and sometimes it's not planned. Okay, I think that's how we found out about Powell's availability. Certainly, it wasn't public information, because the uproar afterwards about, you know, had we had known he was available, you know, we would have tried to trade for him also. In other words, other teams would have said that. So it wasn't really public information that he was available. It was something we came upon through discussions with the GM. You know, we had the pieces that they were looking for. They were looking to create some cap flexibility. So we had Kwame Brown. I think he was on a $9 or a $10 million contract on a one-year deal. So you could trade a one-year guy and take back a guy in a multi-year deal. We had young players. that they had interest in, and we had our draft picks. So 2 weeks, maybe 2.5 weeks, the negotiation process took about that long. Mike Heisley, I believe, was the owner of the team at that time, and Chris Wallace was the GM. So I know Chris went back and forth with Mike and got back to me on different directions he wanted to go to make a deal. The last 3 or 4 days, it heated up quite a bit, and that's when the negotiation really takes place. But I would say the process was about 2.5 weeks.
You had gone through with Kobe at that time, you know, his frustrations of wanting to win and his trade, at the time, his trade request, which came and went. If Gasol doesn't come in that deal, do you think Kobe finishes his career there? Was he at a point where there would have been a point where he would have just, his patience would have run out? Because he didn't have much patience anyway.
Well, the summer before the Powell deal is when Kobe publicly wanted to be traded. And we researched, you know, possibilities. And to trade a guy like Kobe, you've got to get an awful lot back in return. You've got to get all the best players from the other team and some. So anytime I would talk to another team and I would say, well, I want this, 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 and this, and this, and I would think about it, that they would say, well, Mitch, if I did that, we'd have nothing left but Kobe. And I would say to myself, that's true, and Kobe would be in the exact same spot he is now with your team. So I had discussions with Kobe and his representative explaining that to him. Now, if we would have traded Kobe to a place that had a lot of talent and we would have taken back a second-round pick, then maybe, you know, that team and Kobe would be happy. Okay, but looking back on it, we weren't going to do that.
Did you feel when you were talking with other teams, did you feel you were going through the motions in a sense that I still don't know in the end if he's going to sign off on this, but I've got to play along with this. I've got to go down this road. I've got to show him we're trying. Did you ever think there was a scenario where he was going to say, like the Detroit conversations, did you ever really believe he wanted out, or did you think he was just angry?
I think he was angry and frustrated. If you know Kobe, it's about work, competing, and winning. That's all he was about, work, competing, and winning. So, obviously, we didn't do it. And I think we knew a little bit more about Andrew Bynum than he did at that time. Mm-hmm. Andrew was still young and hadn't shown much to date. But that, we didn't make a deal. And that training camp, you know, it was a little tense.
You know, that was after the Jason Kidd when you decided you did not want to do Bynum.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't remember exactly when the Jason Kidd thing came up. But this is the season after Kobe wanted to be traded. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in training camp. And then the first game of the season, you know, we didn't know how our fans would react. And it was a mixed reaction when, you know, Kobe was introduced. But Andrew came out gangbusters. And after like 7 or 8 games, you know, I don't know our exact record. We were 8-1 or 7-3 or whatever it is. And Kobe made a comment, something to the effect of, this is the guy I was talking about. Okay. And Andrew was just a great, great player with all the upside in the world until mid-January when he heard his name. And then that's when things went, you know, we went from the best record in the NBA in the West to a team that now may lose a bunch of games and maybe fall into the lottery. And then I think in end of January or mid-January or early February is when we made the Pau Gasol deal. And that got us just a rebirth in the middle of the season. And without Andrew Bynum, you know, made it to the NBA Finals against Boston.
Support for the Woj Pod comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They understand that home plays a big role in your life and family. That's why they created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. It's convenient. Our trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. And in addition to getting a real mortgage approval in minutes, you can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time and make sure you're getting the right solution for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Woj. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. At most points in modern Laker history, when you've had to find a way to get a great player, you have, and it goes back to, you know, when you were working with Jerry West, getting Shaq in free agency, working the draft day deal for Kobe Bryant. You know, we talk about the Pau Gasol deal, and then you get to this crossroads where you make a deal for Chris Paul, and now you've set yourselves up again here to, you know, to start building around Kobe Bryant, Chris Paul, and going forward. Take me through that process. And again, it just felt like you had the assets to make a big deal. You made the deal, and then you get a phone call from Dell Demp saying, the New Orleans GM saying what?
Well, that was a three-team deal, and all general managers agreed on the deal. And in our business, a general manager doesn't agree to do a deal unless he has ownership's approval. And everybody assured each other that they had the necessary approval to make the deal. So we had our conference call between the three of us, and we made the deal. Dr. Buss was in the hospital. I remember going over to the hospital and visiting with him and Jim, and we were all, you know, a little bit melancholy because we'd have to lose Powell and Lamar, but the ability to get a young all-star point guard, and at that point, Andrew Bynum was still a big part of our future, along with Kobe, we thought this would be the perfect transition into another 8 or 10 year period where we can be very, very competitive. Later on in the afternoon, I did get a call from, you know, one of the teams, the New Orleans team, saying that, very apologetically, that the deal will not go through, which was shocking.
At any point in those negotiations, it was Houston, New Orleans, the Lakers, on that multiplayer deal, were you always dealing with New Orleans, or did you have to deal with the league office at any point when you were talking about that trade? Because at the time, obviously, the league was acting as the owner to, at the time, the Hornets.
I always talked to my counterpart.
Okay. 3 days later, after the trade is killed by David Stern, the league office, you traded Lamar Odom to Dallas. You got a first-round pick back for him. What went on in those 2 or 3 days with where Lamar was mentally, where Pau Gasol, because you had traded these players away, and now it was you have to figure out, can we reincorporate them into our team? What went on there?
I think this was prior to the end of the lockout. Well, the lockout ended, and then we had like 5 or 6 days of training camp and time you can make a trade. So I think it was in December at some time. And when the deal fell through, you know, both Lamar and Pau came into the office, and they both took it differently, but both of them were distraught and hurt, understandably so. You know, a tough decision, you know, that we had to make. You know, that's my job, that's Jim's job, and that's Dr. Buss's job. You know, he was still in control of the team and running the team. They were distraught, both hurt and emotional. Pau, I think, handled it a little bit better. Lamar was just hurt beyond words. You know, he had found a home in Los Angeles. He had helped us win 2 championships. He was a great teammate. I think he had just won Sixth Player of the Year award the year before. And I've never seen a player, and I've unfortunately had to inform players for a long, long time that they've been traded, sometimes in person, most of the time by the phone, and you kind of know how they're going to react. But Lamar was beside himself. And at that point, you know, there really wasn't much that we could do. The deal was not on the table anymore, the deal that we had agreed to. A day went by. I got a call from his representative saying that he doesn't think it's going to work. You know, Lamar wants to be traded. And nobody knows Lamar better than we did. And we didn't feel that he'd be able to come back to this team. He had lost trust in us. I mean, I get it. You know, we had something special. You know, but it is a business. So you try to balance both of those things. Sometimes you always don't get it right as an owner or as a GM. He wasn't going to play in training camp. He didn't want to be a part of the team. So at that point, you know, the only option we really had was to look to make a move. And we felt after 3 or 4 days, the best thing to do was to make the best deal possible. And looking back on it, I think we did the right thing. We did get a first-round pick. And unfortunately, Lamar was never able to play up to the same level that he played with us. And I don't know what the reasons are for that. Had we not made the trade, I think he would have had a great year for us. I really do. But the fact that we made the trade and then it fell through, I think he had lost complete trust in our organization.
So when David Stern comes out recently, or in the last few months, and says, really puts blame on you that, I think you used the term panic, that you panicked and traded Lamar Odom a few days later, and that kept the teams from finding a new pathway to that Chris Paul trade, that somehow that trade was still in play, the bigger trade, that it could have been repackaged with different assets and completed. Your reaction to that is?
You know, when we made the deal and the deal fell through, I really just moved on from it. And I didn't want our fans to attach themselves to a deal that was never going to happen. And my feeling was is to move on and let it go and work on the next deal. So it's come up a couple of times in the last 3 or 4 years, most recently the time you just mentioned. And I don't know the context, you know, under which David said what he said. You know, so, you know, I'm sure he was with a group of people or he was at a seminar or something, and there was a lot left out. But having said that, there was only three people that know why we traded Lamar when we did. And I kind of walked through a little bit of it. But Dr. Buss, Jimmy Buss, and myself, we're the only three people that know why we did what we did. And I don't think Dr. Buss shared with David why we did what we did. So I'm assuming he doesn't know why we did it. So looking back on it, we're 100%, or at least I'm 100% comfortable with the decision. Maybe there was a deal there that was going to happen a month later or 2 months later. But talking to the other people involved with the other teams, none of us knew of a pending deal that was going to take place.
Yeah, and when he said those most recent comments, I had a few people who are still in the league who were on different teams then, teams in New Orleans, Houston, who just said, that is just, it's unfair to Mitch. That's not true. That thing was gone and that deal was dead. And you think back of the repercussions that you said, Powell got over it and handled it, processed it better, but probably never fully got over that. Ended up leaving in free agency. And then Lamar, who, if you were going to keep that team together, you didn't really want to trade him. You want, if Lamar was locked in and you said had just been sixth man of the year, the ramifications for the Lakers going forward were dramatic by the league office pulling apart a deal that if they were running the team, which they were, why did they allow it to get to an agreement? I remember I reported it was done, and then I remember I got a call that David Stern had just killed it, which was hard to understand. I remember I got another source on it because it didn't – I knew that New Orleans had been working hand in hand with all of this with the league office. They weren't surprised. And so you were trying to understand why did they backtrack on this. But the impact on the Lakers and your tenure there, you couldn't repair it.
Well, we ended up keeping Powell for another couple of years. He became a free agent. And I do think, you know, the fact that we did have him traded and then it fell through. And although he was able to recover, and I think he and I have a great relationship even to this day, I think there was some hurt and mistrust that factored into his decision to move on as a free agent when he became a free agent and went to Chicago. I understand. But once again, you know, just talking about what we're talking about, it's really counter to the way I approach things as a general manager. You know, when the deal fell through and we didn't feel there was going to be a deal, and Jimmy and Dr. Buss and I met and talked about it several times, we made a decision and we moved on, and I tried to move on as quickly as possible. And I did not want animosity with our fans and the NBA or David Stern or anything else. It was just move on and move on to the next deal and try to create a team and an environment that's good for the existing players. I mean, we had a team to look after. We had a training camp that was starting in a day or two. We had a very, very talented team. So we were in preparation for a team that was getting ready to make a playoff run during a strike-shortened season. So that's my take on it. Hopefully it doesn't come up again. I'm not comfortable talking about it. I have let it go when it happened, and hopefully this is the end of it.
You worked in the front office. You were trained under Jerry West, and you became a general manager and had a long run. Now, you'd mentioned spending some time going, spend a few days with different teams. You could have maybe some different conversations with other executives now than you could when you were competing with them. Maybe pick people's brains a little differently than you can when they're a rival. Do you look forward to that, to sort of get a sense of how other people are doing things? You've been most of your professional life with the Lakers, you know, certainly a way of doing things. And to kind of go out now and look around and see what other people are doing.
I'm excited about it. I would put the group that I worked with the Lakers, you know, whether it's basketball operations or business, you know, the marketing people, the season seat people, TV people, I put them up against any team in the NBA. I felt that they were always supportive and a great group of people to work with and for. Having said that, it's always good to get out and see how other teams do business. Certainly this is not something that would be possible if I was employed by the Lakers, because everybody keeps things close to their vest. You know, someone from another team is not going to say, "Hey, Mitch, you know, come to the office for 2 or 3 days and come see how we do things here." But that's not the case right now. The case right now is that I have the time to do it. I have relationships with owners and general managers in the league. And a couple of teams have welcomed me to come visit them during training camp. So next week, rather than just, you know, kind of sit around and not be a part of something that's been a part of my life for so many years, I'm going to spend a couple of days with a couple, three teams and watch their practices, meet with their coaches, try to get into their front office a little bit. I'm sure they're going to ask me how we did things in Los Angeles. I don't know why they wouldn't. So that's going to be a fun thing and hopefully an informative thing for me.
Have you decided in your mind, do you know exactly what you might want to do next?
No, I don't. We joked earlier, if I had $2 billion, that it'd be fun to buy a basketball team. And the Lakers treated me well over the years. But the last time I checked, I did not have $2 billion in my bank account. So, but hey, wouldn't that be fun to be involved in owning a team? Or can I be a general manager again? Absolutely. Now, I would hope that I would be in a position to pick and choose and find the right match for me to stay in basketball. That would be great. But that doesn't work that way either. There's only 29, 30 teams in this league, one of which I know probably doesn't want me right now. So there's 29 teams. And one of those teams not only has to have an opening, but they have to, you know, desire your services as well. So I have to balance and juggle, you know, what I want to do, what the opportunities are. You know, if there's a team that does have interest, what other opportunities may come up, you know, in basketball, whether it's the NBA or something, you know, somewhere else. My son, who plays for Santa Barbara, you know, unfortunately, they made a coaching change back in the spring. And a really, really good coach moved on, and they hired another really, really good coach, Joe Pasternak, out of Arizona. But in the interim, I was joking with my son, you know, about, well, you know, Maxwell, I said, you know, what if I applied for the Santa Barbara coaching job? And without a beat, he kind of looked at me and he said, Dad, if you do that, I'll transfer. So I don't know if college coaching is something that I'll pursue, at least not at that level. But, you know, I'll poke around. I'll poke around for a year and see what the opportunities are. Hopefully I'll have some choices.
What do you find out about the league, the profession, your peers, when you lose your job? The people you've worked with, some maybe closer than others, how have people reacted with you reaching out, offering? Did you learn something new about the league in that process?
I did, almost immediately. And I can go back and do the double check on it, but I think every general manager, within 3 or 4 days, of course today it's all texting, either texted me or called me and expressed, you know, concern. Some people were more, you know, vocal than others. You know, some people, you know, just, you know, Mitch, sorry to see it, you know, enjoyed working with you. And I didn't really expect that. I expected that from my friends in the league that I've worked with and known for 15, 20 years. But a lot of the new guys that have come in the last 3 or 4 years, I didn't expect to see that compassionate side of them. And that was a good feeling.
Mitch, I appreciate you coming in, spending the time. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Woj Pod. A big thank you to my guest in studio today, Mitch Kupchak. Remember, you can subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of the Woj Pod wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to your shows. You can also hear the Woj Pod every Wednesday and Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, on Sirius Channel 214, XM Channel 203, and on the Sirius XM app on Channel 967. And of course, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors today, Spotify and SeatGeek. Be sure to support them the way they support us here at the Woj Pod. We'll catch you next time.